we have to think outside of the box instead of just trying to channel most of our energy into the electoral fights. What are the other things that we have to build on the side that parallel this, that are actually building power in our communities and organizing people to exercise that power? We have to give as much time to the build as we're doing to the fight, and we have to give equal time to actually sitting down in our communities, having meetings with our neighbors, whether they agree or disagree with us, and constructing a real political and viable program going forward. So let us seize the time and opportunity. Don't be weary. You know, there's plenty of people out there to talk to who want to be organized. Get to work.
That's Kali Akuno, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Kali Akuno on activism, lessons from Mississippi. Mao said a single spark can start a prairie fire. Indeed it can. Rosa Parks is a perfect example of that. Her refusal to sit in the back of the bus led to the Montgomery bus boycott and the beginning of the civil rights movement in the segregated South. There are some erroneous notions about Rosa Parks, that she was simply tired and had to rest her weary feet. Yeah, she was tired, all right, tired of the racism and discrimination. And Rosa Parks was not some casual activist. She was part of a movement that triggered a wave of protest and eventually broke down an entrenched system of injustice. It didn't happen overnight. One of the lessons activists have learned is that for their work to be successful, it must be sustained over periods of time. Our guest today is Kali Akuno. He spoke over several days in Madison, Wisconsin. I usually give the speaker's bio, but in this instance, let's hear it directly from him. And now, Kali Akuno.
My name is Kali Akuno with Cooperation Jackson, based in Jackson, Mississippi. I'm also with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, which is a national organization, an organization of people of African descent, and has about 10 chapters spread throughout the country. I'm bringing both of these up because Cooperation Jackson, number one, in many respects is a child of that organization. But it also, I think, gives a range of the broad base of which I want to kind of center some of my comments in, at least from the beginning, and then get to some more specifics around Jackson, because I believe, you know, in our practice, we have to be rooted somewhere firmly on the ground in order to have a basis on which to stand from and some practice that you can point to as illustrative of what you're, you know, struggling for, what you're trying to articulate. So I'm going to try to straddle between the two. Why? I'm going to make an argument that, and this is making an assumption about everybody in the room, but I'm making a safe assumption that most folks would consider themselves on the left here. But I would argue that in many respects, our side of the present equation do not equate to our ideas, our theories, and our principles. And that we have to make, you know, some balance, some unity between the two very, very quickly. And not necessarily just because number 45 is in office. In many respects, I think that's a symptom of a deeper crisis that we have to figure out and we got to deal with. So let me do kind of like a call and response and see. Hopefully this will illustrate what I mean. So how many people think that 63 degree weather in Madison in February is normal? I see one hand that says this is normal. Not normal. Okay, not normal at all. How many people here think 63 degree weather in Madison in February is dangerous? Okay. So let me ask, in some respects, the same question another way. How many people here think that there's still room for reform under capitalism? Regulated. I'm trying to build some consensus here, so speak up. We don't think it's that reformable for the most part. Do we have a program that speaks to this principle? Do we have a program that speaks to this perspective that we hold? So I think I unite with you. But the central point, and folks who couldn't hear in the back said there are too many programs. We have too many programs. There are too many sectarian, small little sects of 25 and 30 and maybe a couple of hundred people running around thinking we're going to, you know, with that 200 or 300 people unite in 200 plus million without a really a broad base of mass-based practice, right? So theory divorced from all reality. But I'm raising this point because I think there's more broad consensus, but we don't have the program, or we haven't developed the program, or we haven't struggled enough with each other, I think, to develop this program. And I think the situation now, you know, points in the direction that if we don't get our act together real quick, 45 will be the least of our concerns, right? The least of our concerns. Because what's happening right now with this, you know, freakish weather, now I like it hot, so it's good for me to be here. And, you know, this is kind of cold for Mississippi, to be honest, still. But it ain't normal, right? It's not how the earth regulates or has been regulating itself, at least for the past couple of thousand years, to where other complex life can understand the rhythms and flows and move and act accordingly, right? I know in some of our area, you know, the plants are blooming too soon. And what does that mean? The birds and the bugs are not, you know, doing their normal cycle at the right time, so they're totally off, right? You know, the bugs are coming out too earlier. Then the birds are having laying their eggs too late, you know, which is pointing both towards imbalance. And you start showing up real early in the birds, you know, beginning many to their reproductive cycles going down, leading towards extinction. And we don't yet fully grasp that how we are dependent on all of those birds and all of those bugs and all the little things that are in the ground for our own existence, right? We think we're a little bit smarter than what we really are, and we have a deeper grasp on how this earth works than what we really do. And we think we can keep abusing it in particular ways, and it's not going to hurt us, so that we'll be smart enough to come up with some techno fix or, you know, some new gadget or some new trick that's going to get us out of a serious bind. Don't work that way. Don't work that way. So we are arguing that we have to come up with a serious, our side of the equation has to come up with a serious program and engage in some serious dialogue in the here and now. And I'm challenging all of us to engage in that. You know, I'm not going to put a time limit on it, but we need to engage in that as much as we are out in the streets fighting against what 45 and all these reactionary, you know, conservatives are doing. So I want you to hold on to that. Because we can do, and we should do, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be out there fighting against every single thing that they do. We should. But the reality is we don't have the capacity to fight them right now on every single thing that they do. And we got to be real about that and deal with the sad consequences of it too, right? And that what I mean by that is there are some losses that we are going to take in this next period. I don't like saying that, but I'm just trying to be honest and truthful in saying that there are some losses that we're going to take in this next period. And to get ourselves mentally prepared for that and do the organizing that is necessary so that we have backup plans to withstand the first level and first round of assaults against what little democracy has ever existed in this country, that they're trying to eliminate it even further and take us back to the 16th century. Because that's what their program is. I mean, let's don't be confused about what they're really trying to do. You know, part of it is about, you know, returning the rate of profit. That's a, you know, we're not denying it. I wouldn't deny it at all. But they want to do it in such a manner that, you know, those who are supposed to be, you know, in their respective places go back in their places. And that's virtually everybody, right? Once you really think about it, being white is not going to necessarily protect you from that, you know, illogic. Because women will go back in the home if they have anything to say about it, or go back to domestic duties and on down the list. So we have to, you know, really, I think, develop a serious program, and that starts with dialogue amongst us. And there's a couple of things. You know, one of the things that we've been, myself, have really been promoting on a national level is a framework. I want to call it that more so than anything, this framework of ungovernability. And what that's fundamentally about is we are, do not give any legitimacy to number 45 and, more importantly, to what at least we are calling the neo-Confederates, who I would argue are actually far more dangerous and have a far more dangerous program than what Trump is really trying to do. Because I would argue in many respects what Trump is really there to do is to renegotiate the terms of empire and distract. But that's fundamentally what his job is. And I think he's going to do an excellent job at it. Not everybody's going to go to Europe or send a team to Europe and say, hey, we're going to renegotiate NATO. We're going to renegotiate our relationship with the EU. We're paying too much. We don't want to pay anymore. Right? They're renegotiating the terms of empire. That's a critical piece of what his whole trip was about. And regardless of who was going to be there, if Hillary would have won, she would have had to do some of the fundamental things because the world has changed. America is not the top dog like it used to be 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, right? And it's on, sometimes only the people in the United States don't quite get grasp that reality, you know, but it ain't the same world that it used to be. Now, he's still under some notion that, you know, he's like John Wayne and he can just, you know, pull out a pistol and everybody's going to duck and run for cover. You know, China's not going to blink in the same way it once did. Russia's not going to blink in the same way it once did. The terms are different. The economy is different. The structure of the world is profoundly different. And so they got to renegotiate some terms, and it's going to be different. I mean, it probably, in some respect, I would argue, and this is a deeper conversation, is that there's, I don't want to call it a passing of the torch, because I don't believe fundamentally in hegemonic forces, but I think that is in part what is playing itself out. And that's dangerous because the last two times it's happened in the capitalist world system, it's always led to profound war, wars of profound disruptions that are only mediated through war and the process of creative destruction. And I'm kind of like Einstein, that, you know, we don't quite sure know how World War III would play out, but we know the result of World War IV. Folks will be back to sticks and stones, right? If these madmen kind of have their way with the tools and toys that they have, which they possess. So I'd like to avoid that. I'd like to avert that as much possible, and I hope most of you want to do that as well. But that means we got to get ourselves profoundly more organized than what we are now. And we are not an organized force. Let's not kid ourselves. With the unions, with our political parties, we're not as organized even as much as we once were 20 and 30 years ago. Does it mean that we don't know how to do that? Not in a whole. I think we do still know a lot of those tried and true techniques. And what I mean by organized, I'm not talking about creating a great internet platform. That's not what I'm talking about. That'll help us do some things. It'll help us do some things faster. But we need to be organized on the level to where I can say with certainty how many people I can get to commit to doing that action, right, without a moment's hesitation. That's organized. Say, man, okay, you know, you call me, give me 2 days, I can move 50 people, put them in action. And we can agree on, you know, if it's a political action, and if that's a demonstration or for some other action, whatever it may be, but making sure that I'm in contact with that many people who are ready to act and are trained enough to act on the ground in my community. That's the level of organizing that I'm talking about that I think we have to get to. We've done it once before, you know, in all of our societies we've done it once before, and we can do it again. It's hard work. It's not magic. It's just a bunch of hard work. Dialoguing, you know, dealing with each other's contradictions, dealing with each other's shortcomings, dealing with each other's failings. That's ultimately what we're going to have to do and get to. The other piece that I think we have to do with this, we have to make a serious struggle around the means of production, and particularly around some of the new means of production that are emerging and developing rather quickly. And to a degree, we've always been engaged in it. So I'm not necessarily proposing anything new. But I think there's a difference between arguing for a job and fighting to control the economy. Those are two different things. And I think that for many of us, particularly the most vulnerable amongst us, capitalism has already emerged and developed to a point where there are profound surplus populations all over the globe. Right? And I think now it's trying to develop the political will to get rid of some of those surpluses. That's also, I think, part of what 45 is about. Like, you know, can we put somebody in place who has the political will and political nerve and gumption to just eliminate whole sectors of humanity? And we should not be surprised that it's on the table. The system has done it before, and left unchecked, it will do it again. Right? It will do it again. So we shouldn't shy away from that, I think, or act like it's not there. Because from what I see a lot of times, there's a constant kind of acting like, I can't believe they did that, or I can't believe that this is happening. I can't believe, and it speaks to a profound disconnect that's been happening to indigenous people all along, that's been happening to black people all along, you know. But understand that it can get worse. Right? It can get worse, and we have to get prepared for that. So arguing and, I think, struggling for that, I think, is the key thing. And I want to argue that I don't think that we do enough throughout this country to have a serious conversation between what is left of organized labor, and I'm saying that intentionally, right, and what is emerging as the cooperative field in this country. We aren't in deep enough dialogue and conversation with each other about how, as workers, and we're all workers, how, as workers, we're going to shape our own future. And I'm saying that because a big part of what Cooperation Jackson is based upon is a black reality that ain't nobody creating no jobs for us. That day is long since past. And where I'm at in Jackson, Mississippi, the real unemployment rate easily is over 50%. I can knock on almost any door in a black working class community any day of the week, and there's an able-bodied adult typically who will answer the door any time of day to just give you a real sense of what I mean by deep level unemployment. Now, that is a challenge in terms of income, but that's also a great organizing opportunity. So I think we got to look at it, and that's what we've been trying to do. Let's put that on his head. Flip it. You have some time and energy. Can we utilize that to do something collective in our community? Can we bring your skills, time, energy, resources, and talents together with other folks under similar circumstances as you and transform our reality? Now, it takes a lot of convincing of people. Folks just ain't going to come out their house and, you know, just because you show up with a great idea and automatically jump on it. It don't work that way in Jackson. It don't work that way anywhere I've ever lived. But we are starting to see some results in taking that approach, right, and getting people to just start doing small things. You know, let's help pull together some time and energy to fix the cars and bikes and stuff in the neighborhood to deal with the transportation crisis that we have in our city. Jackson is a city, there's a few public buses, but we don't really have a public transportation system, to be honest with you, right? So if you don't have a car, you are pretty much kind of assed out in terms of, you know, trying to get a job or going to the grocery store, and there are a lot of people in that situation. Well, that's an opportunity also for us from an organizing perspective because it helps us to kind of put people in relationship. I have a car. I have some time. You know how to fix car. You have some time. Let's work together, and we can work creating kind of a mutual system. And now one of the next steps that we are working on, actually, how do we create our own kind of cab company, right, cooperative cab company? And for us, it's like looking at it on a deeper level, how is it fulfilling a social need, not just a transportation, but a social need in our community, right? So some deeper things that I think we have to look at a lot of these challenges is, you know, from the space of our own autonomy, from the space of our own agency, how can we turn all of these particular crises on their head and turn them into opportunities? Right? And so a part of it is a challenge of how we are looking, you know, at the new world. And rather than see some of the limitations, see it as there's more space from the decay of late capitalism to actually do some things to push back and make that case to start seizing the means of production, first building them up, but also gradually taking them over and assuming them. That is a big part of our project in Jackson and what we've been fighting for with the Jackson-Cush plan. Now, that's nothing ever stays static or, you know, stays in one place. So things have profoundly changed in Jackson since 2014 when Chokwe passed. We have put his son up to run for mayor. He's running for mayor now. By all indications, as of right now, we're well ahead in the lead. I don't expect us to lose, but I expect far more challenges for us under this term than what his father faced. The city is under profound debt. We are being faced with the threat of losing control over our water system. Our public education system is going to be seized this summer by the state through primarily an orchestration of state-mandated testing, and they change the goalposts every year to produce the outcome that they wanted. After 3 years of successive Fs, when they change the test every single year, and the teachers have to teach to the test, right? And if you change the test on the teachers, you know, that means the students are not getting in part what they need. But this is the game that they played. And since it was statewide, we couldn't quite pull together the coalition to stop it. But that's one thing, a new term that we have. And then our governor is very, very close to Trump. The Tea Party basically runs our state. Our governor is a member of the Tea Party. There's a Tea Party supermajority in the legislature in both houses and also within the state court system. So we've been living under kind of this one-party rule that now everybody's experiencing for 6 years. So we've learned a few lessons that perhaps we can impart. Similar here now, too, right? For 6 years, it's like that. I thought there was a Democratic legislator until about 2 years ago here, majority.
A handful.
Not a majority. Not a majority. Well, similar, okay. So this is our reality, you know, kind of what we're dealing with. And because of how close our governor is to Trump, Trump has given him certain promises that he can do some things that the Army Corps of Engineers has been telling the state of Mississippi that have been impossible for almost 25 years. And so he's been bragging and boasting since the inauguration that they're going to create a whole new water system for Rankin County, which is a predominantly white working class county, the home of the Klan in Mississippi, that's right next door to Jackson. The county only has 40,000 people. But they're going to build them a whole new water system, right, where they don't even have the density to pay for the water bill for the system that they're going to create. But the point is, it's more political, because Jackson receives 42% of its annual revenue from the sale of water to the greater metro area. So if you take water away from us, basically you destroy the ability of the municipality to in effect, function. So it's a deep-seated political reason. It has nothing to do with providing a service. It's just how do you break the back of a political unit that you don't want having or exercising power, right? So that's a particular piece. And what they're planning on doing, in our case, is annexing a critical part of the what they call the downtown area, where 60% of the jobs in the city of Jackson are located in this new district that they're creating, and turn that over to the governor. And then they want to create, in addition to this additional water system, they want to flood a good portion of downtown Jackson to create a lake and a casino district. You know, the deeper point of this, these are all symptoms of just little pieces of a plan. The long-term objective is to break the political back of Jackson. Jackson is 85% black. 85% black. And by their calculation, they can take Jackson back politically if they are able to reduce Jackson's current black population down to 65 to 60%. Then that gives them enough, you know, power and force demographically to be able to split the black vote and then get whatever candidate that they want in. So this is all part of a long-term coordinated plan and strategy, and the level at which they are dialoguing and coordinating and working with each other. I'm citing all this to give you an example of what organization looks like and what we need to do to get to that level of also sophisticated coordination, strategy, development, organizing. Their side can do it, our side can do it. We just have to break certain habits and certain perspectives which keep us from dialoguing with each other, keep us from seriously struggling with each other, and keep us from working with each other in coordinated ways, even when we disagree. That is a critical weakness that we have, that we have to figure out how to overcome, and we better do so quickly. And the last thing I do want to say that we've been pushing, I'm just offering this in part as an honest, from our perspective, warning. You know, the Democratic Party, as it's presently constructed, and I don't believe it can be reformed. Let me make that clear, personally. But it's not going to save us, y'all. This group, if you're expecting it to save you from 45, if you're expecting it to save you from Scott Walker's, it's not going to happen. We got to organize something different. And it may, you know, take some remnants of that old structure with it. But we got to organize something different, something new that's going to reach the vast majority of those who are oppressed, exploited, and excluded in this society. And it's something that can be done. I don't think it's going to take a lot of hard work. Let's not elude ourselves that it's not. But we have to remember all of what these Tea Party Republican folks, 45, they can only represent a minority from this point forward. That is all they can represent. Now, they can rule effectively as a minority. Let's not be confused ourselves or elude ourselves that they can't. You know, we need to look at South Africa and understand how a minority can effectively rule an overwhelming majority. But we have to recognize that there, if we look in a different way and organize in a different way, there's a profound new majority, which is black, brown, and everything else in between, that we can tap into, have to tap into, that I think is more than willing and willing to be politically engaged. They just don't see the electoral form as the only viable form of doing it, or as the most expedient in doing it to deal with their real life situation and circumstances. So we have to think outside of the box, those upon the left, instead of just trying to channel most of our energy into the electoral fights, what are the other things that we have to build on the side that parallel this, that are actually building power in our communities and organizing people to exercise that power? People's assemblies is one, cooperatives are another, but those are not the only form. Those are just two particular types of tools that we've been trying to work on develop, but that's not it. But I would argue, again, going to that same point, we have to give as much time to the build as we're doing to the fight, and we have to give equal time to actually sitting down in our communities, having meetings with our neighbors, whether they agree or disagree with us, and constructing a real political and viable program going forward. If we don't, again, 45 is going to be the least of our concerns, the least of our concerns. I think this is a hell of a time. I think we should embrace the fluidity of the time and not be afraid of it. For any of you, you know, out there like me who you know, consider yourself a socialist, I would not have believed I could actually even say that in many places publicly 2 years ago. But that space is now open, and it's one that we need to seize. And not let that moment pass or fade, because there's millions of people out there looking for alternatives and are hungry for it, And if we're silent, we're not engaged, we're not, really pressing forward the dialogue, we're missing a critical moment. This is a very fluid moment. It may look bleak from how the structure is set up. But again, they're a minority. They don't have much room or maneuverability. At the end, they have a few economic things, that levers that they can pull, which are very serious and shouldn't be underestimated. But, you know, we know that they're going to have to resort to force in order to keep this thing together. And that's a losing combination at the end of the day. So let us seize the time and opportunity. Don't be weary. You know, there's plenty of people out there to talk to who want to be organized. Get to work.
You're listening to Kali Akuno on Activism, Lessons from Mississippi. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Again, I want to apologize to all of you for coming up here and being sick. That was not in the original program or design. And I just want to dive in. I'm feeling a little bit better than I did yesterday. And so the mind, I think, will be a little bit sharper than it was yesterday, hopefully. But my body is feeling actually worse than it felt yesterday. So I may have to, like, walk and, like, move around so my back doesn't get stiff. So just note that. For me, I'm very tired of hearing that Trump is stupid. And that he's just spontaneous, and that he doesn't kind of know what he's doing. I think we're totally selling him short, and we're acting as if some measure of intelligence might save us from the terror that he might unleash upon us. When I think, in fact, he's a very calculated man, and actually a very intelligent man. And he knows how to, you know, blow dog whistles, I mean, well, and he has a sense of history and strategy. And to me, it goes back to how he announced his presidential run this time. And remember, I say this time, because he's ran for president before. I don't know if people know that. This wasn't his first go-around running for president. They kind of downplay that in the media, but I think he learned. And he took a page in his announcement from Ronald Reagan in making his campaign announcement in 2015. And when he went to the border and he had that Make America Great thing piece, he took a page from Reagan's 1979 campaign when he came down to Mississippi. This is Ronald Reagan. For those of you who remember, Ronald Reagan came down to Mississippi and announced his presidential campaign right then and there. Now, many people may in this audience may be too young to remember that or wasn't born when that happened. But that's what Ronald Reagan did. And he sent a clear message from day one, who he was speaking to, you know, what he planned to do. And that resonated and moved large sectors, particularly of the South, to his banner. Donald Trump took that same page and played it masterfully. Right? And that takes a certain amount of both historical acumen and strategic thinking to pull off. Because you don't just stumble upon going to the border, saying, I'm going to force Mexico to create a wall, then come out with a Ronald Reagan slogan and make America great again, because it's not his. That's something he took from Reagan. And to know how that would resonate, right? And to know how much the old Gipper, as they call him, is still loved by a broad spectrum of the right, and as is a uniting force across the right in this country, in this generation. So he was very tactfully from the beginning, trying to call all those who could be united under one banner under him, but particularly aiming towards some elements of the far right, which have been largely or are largely marginalized within the Republican Party. They're on their fringes, they're always on their fringes, but have been largely been marginalized. So that was something that was deliberate and intentional. So for us, I'm bringing these things up because one of the critical things that we have to do, I think, is to clearly understand who our opponents are. And then we have to do an even deeper dive in trying to figure out who the hell are we? And what do we stand for? What do we believe in? What are we willing to fight for? And that is a big challenge for the left right now. Right? Despite many of our ideas, we aren't that clear. And we're on the defensive more often than not, which is not a good place to be when you don't have much money. You don't have your own media, right? You don't have many of your own cultural or political institutions grounded in communities. So being on the defensive, in our case, is a terrible position to be. So how do we go on the offensive? That is one of the fundamental questions, you know, we are trying to pose. And so, and I just so folks are clear, I thought Donald Trump was going to win. And had been trying to prepare anybody who would listen for that reality. You know, the map just lined up too well for him. And once the Democrats ensured that Bernie had no choice, had no chance, that it was pretty much a done deal that he was going to win. Because just looking at in the Mississippi context, she had been buying Mississippi politicians since 2008. And I mean literally buying them. And then she tried to come and do several events in Jackson or have representatives of her team come. And despite all the money that she was spending, she could barely fill a room. So we knew that she was in trouble. And then I think the deeper piece that was missed was the consolidation of the Tea Party, particularly in the Deep South and the Midwest. And I think that's a piece, you know, that we are we don't pay enough attention to. And what do I mean by that? So there's so much focus on Trump. There's not enough focus, in my opinion, on what is now happening in the 33 states that the Republicans completely control. They are one state short of being able to, you know, have a constitutional convention majority. And for those who don't know, if they have that 34, that means they can change fundamental aspects of the Constitution, which they have long held, some of their think tanks, let me put it this way, some of their think tanks have long held as a strategic aim and objective of them having. And they have a clear set of programs. They don't all necessarily agree, but they have plans upon plans about, once we get to that point, we're going to change this. Once we get to that point, we're going to change this. Once we get to that point, we're going to change this. We don't have anything corresponding to the same thing, anything corresponding to even half of what they are thinking and doing. Now, some things that do work in our favor in terms of us figuring out who we are. The Republican side, they are going to have to go through some major transformation to become anything more than a minority, a consolidated minority. Like the way that they have constructed themselves with a deep-rooted centeredness and, you know, just old-school white supremacy, you can dress it up in, you know, so many different ways, but they haven't broke with that. You know, even with several attempts at trying to break with that, attempts at trying to bring in different Asians, different groups of Asians, attempts at trying to bring in different groups of Latinos. They still haven't fundamentally broken with that. And so they are still largely constructed around a diminishing white population. So they, at this point, are still happy with being a minority. And I think they're becoming much more strategic in understanding that we can be a minority if we are able to rig the system in particular ways. So yesterday we talked about gerrymandering and how that's set up to protect certain minorities, just given the way that the system and the Constitution is set up about proportionality and around how many people per district, et cetera. And that was all always set up because, you know, the way this country was set up, there was a divide between the North and the South that was there from the jump. The North being more populous than the South, and the South having a particular species of property that, that couldn't vote, couldn't participate in the political process, right? But they wanted them counted, which is where the three-fourths of a human being comes from as part of the toll, to give one side a particular advantage, even though you were counting people who in no form or fashion could be represent or could represent themselves, right? So that is the basis of the system. It's always been skewed. It's always been off. And it's never been anything remotely democratic from Jump Street. And I say that because I think the left needs to give up any pretension around maintaining the sanctity of the Constitution, which is, I think, sometimes a hard argument for us to really delve in. But from my vantage point, there's not much worth saving about the structure of this empire. Let's take the time, energy, to do something completely new. Now, it might have some elements of the old in it that may be somewhat inevitable, but we don't have to be beholden to the past in order to create something in the new. That doesn't mean that we take away, that for us, that means we abandon the argument around democracy. For me, I think it's the exact opposite. Upholding democracy is not the same thing as defending the Constitution. And that is sometimes how we get pigeonholed. At least I see that in Mississippi. We get pigeonholed. And I was like, no, I'm arguing for something far beyond the Constitution, far beyond what you guys ever intended, you know, for people like me and my ancestors to ever, you know, participate in and be engaged in. And I'm arguing for something far beyond your legitimacy to be able to, you know, enforce upon me or upon anybody else, which is another critical piece. So I think we need to get rid of that kind of hold and argue for something new. I think we really need to dig deep into the radical imagination. I don't think we do enough of that. I don't think the left does enough visioning. And we used to be the side that did most of the visioning. You know, most of your great science fiction came from people who was on our side of the equation, not the other side of the equation. So I want you to think about that, what that means, you know, because that speaks to human aspiration, what we could be, what we could do, what we could aspire to. And I think that's a space that we need to reclaim. And I think we need to abandon these arguments that, you know, people in the United States are too conservative. You know, we can't talk to people because they're too conservative. I don't think that's true. I think, you know, despite what many of us may criticize around Bernie Sanders' campaign, I think the last 10 years with Occupy, with the emergence of movement for Black Lives, I think we're finding that there are far more people out there wanting something profoundly different than we give credit to. I think the issue is we haven't created either the vehicles to reach those folks, right? And that is one of the deep, I think, problems of the left. I think we need to create new things and experiment with different types of mass organizations, right? I think some of the things that we've been seeing with, say, Podemos, or some early aspects of what was happening with Syriza, and some of those things, which you have political forces tied to social movements, you know, in a very organic and concrete way. I think we need to start heading in that direction. How can we start more concretely linking the struggle around Standing Rock and the protection of water, and then the deeper, larger question of indigenous sovereignty? How can we link that more concretely with the struggle for Black liberation? How can we start concretely connecting that with the struggle around, you know, the emancipation of labor? And there's several campaigns which are kind of emerging or being around on the scene that are aiming in that direction. The Fight for 15, probably the most famous, but not the only one. How do we link these things, right? That is one of the critical pieces I think we're going to have to figure out how to do in this next period. And we're going to have to figure out how to do that organically from the bottom up and not, you know, from the instruments of the Democratic Party. This is our challenge that I think that we have to do. I mentioned this ungovernable project, this ungovernable framework that a few of us have put out. We've tried to simplify the aspects of how to wage resistance in this new era, or the present era, into a combination of what we call build and fight, or fight and build. And that is, we have to, in our view, we have to spend as much time building alternative institutions, autonomous grassroots, self-managed, self-directed institutions in our communities. We have to spend as much time as we do that as we spend fighting against all the reactionary stuff that's going to come down. And for us, we've been telling folks, particularly like in the case in Mississippi, you know, last year in 2016, we spent a lot of time and energy. This is Cooperation Jackson in particular. We spent a lot of time and energy fighting a set of reactionary policies that came down from the state legislature aimed at just breaking the sovereignty of Jackson to the extent that it exists, to just breaking it up. Now, we temporarily defeated four of the five most egregious policies, but it came at a cost. It came at a cost that some of our co-ops didn't develop in the way that we had intentionally planned on them developing, you know, from the strategic plan coming in from 2015 into 2016. And then turn around 2017, they're right back with the same four that we defeated, but with even greater force and greater clarity this time around, right? So we had to have a hard conversation, you know, our coordinating committee. We had to have a hard conversation about, we can't fight every single thing. And some things we're just going to have to get our ass kicked on for now. Because it's more important in our evaluation to build up some critical resources for the long-term fight in Mississippi. Right? And they can outspend us. They get all the media access and everything, you know. And there's only so much that our limited forces can do. So, you know, some things just like biting our tongue, we see it passing in the House and we know it's going to have a negative impact. But we're starting to think about, how do we counter that? And how does us building our land trust counter the gentrification that's coming? Right? And how do we educate the community about what's coming down? Even though we couldn't stop, we're not going to be able to stop this capital complex bill, which we call it the downtown annexation bill. We're not going to be able to stop that this time around. But, you know, we can do a deeper thing of organizing the community in a different way to fight in a more long-term and strategic way, right? So it's kind of making some of these trade-offs, I think, in the short term that I think all of us are going to need to think through. And so we've divided us up into build and fight. And one of the, some of the things that we've been saying that our forces need to basically do, you know, is there's a set of things in terms of strengthening our existing organization and building some new institutions around, like, co-ops, you know, timeshares, mutual aid network, sanctuary cities. We got to get real about those things, right? The times demand it, and I think we have to come to a deeper understanding of what some of those things mean. And for us, we're being very clear with folks that, particularly around the sanctuary or freedom city thing, we're asking people, we want people to be clear about that, we're asking people to break the law. And we want everybody to be clear about what that means, because that's going to become a more pressing reality the further this particular administration and this regime goes down the road. We're going to have to make concrete choices to do that. But the supermajority that they have in the legislature, plus the Trump administration, is just a reinforcing, at least for a couple of years, assuming that the democratic process is going to continue. And that's an assumption. They are still locking some things in for quite a long time, at least the Supreme Court, which is becoming more and more critical as we see, you know, with them allowing not only corporate personhood, but now these corporations can spend an unlimited amount of money in electoral politics. We already see the consequence of that, I think, in terms of how the Congress is now presently constructed. So these are some things that we're going to have to really, I think, dive in and deal with. Then the other piece is we're going to have to continue to fight. We can't give that up. But I think being more strategic about when and where we fight, I think, is going to be critical. And that may come as like a hard pill to swallow, but the way I phrased it, you know, at least in some of the conversations we've been having in our internal operations and cooperation in Jackson. So, you know, been trying to put it to a younger audience. Most of our membership, for those who weren't here, most of our membership is very young in Cooperation Jackson. And so they want to go fight everything. You know, they want to go back up to Ferguson. They want to go here. They want to go there. And to a certain extent, we always support that, you know, like go check it out, get some experience, you know, but there's a certain level of saying, okay, look, let's say putting the federal troops into Chicago like he was threatening. And then the next day, he deputizes more people down on the Texas, Arizona, New Mexico border, you know, to lock that up and to hunt down more people. Y'all gonna go want to fight at every single one of them, and do we have the capacity to go all those different places? No, we don't. In Mississippi, they're very brazen about the change and what it means. And it has been a significant change. So one of the things that we are saying is that the second Reconstruction, which basically started 54, 55, all of that, those special arrangements that got created, that they are fundamentally gone. And the last one that you hear, you know, at least on the talk show radios, and to a certain extent we've been hearing in the legislature in Mississippi, is they're very gleefully, you know, happy that the special relationship that the Black community had, and wasn't the only one, but the Black community in the South had with the federal government, meaning that there were certain agreements that had got set primarily in the late 1950s, early 1960s, that the federal government would be a line of defense against the terror of the southern states. That has been an agreement very implicitly. Now, it's not like the federal government comes running to our aid. Don't get that impression. It never happened like that. But there's been an acknowledgement, at least since the early 1950s, that the Black community in the South needed some special protection against the southern states, right? And that there were a number of different things in terms of, you know, how HUD money might be given out, for example. And instead of going to the states, it went to certain cities, particularly Black majority cities. They're straight up saying that day is over. There's nobody coming to protect you anymore. And that is now a political truth, right? All of those arrangements are now basically gone. And I don't think that's fully set in for everybody yet, what that means, right? And what they might do as a result. I think they're still trying to figure out what they're gonna do. But one thing that's been very interesting, they've put forth all these Blue Lives Matter bill kind of things, right? And Louisiana, I think, passed the first. And the Blue Lives Matter thing is, you know, like if you argue with a cop, you can get a felony, right? Or if they say that you argue with them or looked at them wrong, then you can get a felony. Just whatever, you know, just breathe on them the wrong way, right? And you go on to jail. But the one that they put up to me that was the most revealing. In Mississippi, they introduced two bills, one in the House and one in the Senate, to reintroduce vagrancy laws. And for those of you who don't know what the vagrancy law was, that was a way after slavery was formally ended to re-enslave Black folks in the South that lasted roughly until the 1940s, vagrancy laws throughout the South. Which is to say that, you know, if you were just walking downtown, you know, in a city, and the police decided to pick you up, they can just charge you for being a vagrant and put you in prison, right? And you had to go through, you know, oftentimes a long legal process to clear your name. And how many people had the resources to defend themselves? Not many. So for them to bring that back clearly speaks to where they're trying to go, or at least a section of them, or where they're trying to go. You know, we need to be clear on what some of them are thinking about, and it's the time for us to get clear on, again, who we are, where we're going, what we want to see. And that's going to take a lot more dialogue and debate and discussion with each other than I think we've allotted the time for, or taking ourselves seriously enough to engage in. But we got to do it now, and we got to do it quickly.
That was Kali Akuno on activism, lessons from Mississippi. He spoke in Madison, Wisconsin. Kali Akuno is a co-founder and co-director of Cooperation Jackson, a network of cooperatives and other worker-owned, democratically self-managed enterprises. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Vandana Shiva, David Corton, Angela Davis, Arun Gandhi, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Naomi Klein, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Kali Akuno on Activism, Lessons from Mississippi, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Norm Stockwell recorded the program. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.